wish I was a baby in mama's arm. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. If I was a baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. It's listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this December 23rd Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. Today on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick continues his discussion about post-apartheid South Africa with historian and activist John Saul in part two of an interview originally aired on December 9th. They discuss the response of poor blacks as they struggle against the consolidation of corporate power, poverty, and mass unemployment. Jan Hocken interviews Derek Hook, a South African psychologist teaching at Birkbeck College in London, and is a lead researcher with the Apartheid Archive Project in South Africa. They discuss his recent book, Post-Apartheid Conditions, Psychoanalysis and Social Formations, focusing on the Black Consciousness Movement and its ongoing influence on South African youth, as well as the work of Steve Biko, one of the leaders of the BC movement, and his contributions to A Psychology of Social Change. In the second half of our program, Bill Resnick interviews American historian and writer Paul Buell. They discuss his latest graphic book project, Radical Jesus. And Tom Becker concludes our program with a piece by John Bellamy Foster titled The Epochal Crisis. Foster argues that capitalism has entered an epochal crisis that is unsustainable and with consequences as yet unknown. Well, I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in this morning. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll open this morning's show with Bill Resnick talking with South Africa historian and activist John Saul. And earlier this month, Bill Resnick interviewed John Saul, an historian of South Africa, on why, after the defeat of the apartheid state, has the subordination and life conditions not markedly improved? In fact, many became further impoverished with a rise in unemployment, as the country itself had a considerable increase in growth and national income. John Saul explained that South African white elite, supported by the U.S. and Europe, offered to end apartheid and permit a one-person, one-vote political structure with periodic fair elections if the African National Congress leadership, who were expected to win the election, would accept a constitution that gave the minority white party a veto power over legislation and a constitution that privileged property and the existing corporate structure. The deal was struck, and it led to a black government presiding over an economy that did permit some well-connected blacks, including much of the leadership of the African National Congress, to amass considerable wealth. Some, in fact, fabulous riches. The deal also permitted some few highly educated and technically trained blacks into middle-class positions and to live in guarded suburbs or to integrate cities. But the vast majority of blacks remained poor with little employment and few prospects. And this was part one of the interview and aired on December 9th and is available on the website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now we pick up that interview with Bill Resnick and John Saul on post-apartheid South Africa.
So I'm afraid there's a downward spiral here, but it's inherent in the original terms of transition and the ANC's abandonment of a more radical policy, if indeed they ever had one.
That's the situation now in South Africa, but it doesn't really describe what's happening on the ground, which is an enormous amount of resistance, struggle, not terribly well organized.
Well, I think it's important to realize that there is enormous resistance. I mean, South Africa leads the global table in terms of the signs of local resistances and the responses to the oppressive conditions in which people find themselves. It's a high, high need society in terms of resistance. There are also a whole range of trade union and working class actions. Now, this sometimes takes place outside the official channels, and quite often, in fact, outside the official channels of COSATU, which is linked to the ANC in some kind of a coalition.
COSATU is the labor union.
And this is why I think the moment of Marikana, which everybody I'm sure will recognize as having been a situation at a mine in South Africa, not far from Pretoria, where some 36 miners were shot down by the South African Defense Force at a moment in which they were striking against a series of mining companies in that area. Now, this was a very dramatic, and I myself have used the analogy saying this is a bit like the previous moments of South African resistance. If you look at Sharpeville in the late 1950s and 1960, this was the first sign of a mass action against apartheid. If you look at Soweto, that was another dramatic moment that fanned out across the country from the Johannesburg suburb of Soweto. That was a real sign that there was beginning to be a sort of resistance in the 1970s that in the 1980s would become the transforming agent in South Africa. Well, I think Marikana is the same. It's a sign that the class contradictions, and I mean the class contradictions between those at the bottom, unions or more generally in communities, versus those at the top, the white elite and the black elite together, who are making this global capitalist system work in South Africa insofar as it works at all, that there is resistance taking place. Marikana was a kind of a peaceful resistance that the state chose to use sheer firepower to put down. As I said, a number of people were killed, and there's been a constant discussion of Marikana ever since. And in fact, a whole range of senior ANC people have said, this is really, there's something gone wrong here. This is not the way we thought things were going to go. Well, in fact, it was the way things were almost inevitably going to go if they had stuck as they did with the policies they determined to put into play when they came into power. But the fact is that resistance that has fanned out across the communities and across the working class sectors is a vibrant force to be resisted only by sheer force on the part of the authorities, and I'd be very surprised if it can be entirely stopped. And I think, in fact, it may well be transformative in the long run.
And these are community struggles as well, and even environmental struggles. There's a very vibrant environmental movement in South Africa now.
There is. It's certainly a lot about services and the way in which education and health and other things are not being systematically delivered to the population, despite the promises that this would be the way in which they would be treated once and would treat themselves once liberation came, and a growing sense that, as you say, the environment is under siege. A whole range of resistance is cast in those terms. I think if you look at the whole range of things that are happening and add them up, it looks like the basis of a new kind of strategy. It's a matter of finding the political connections that can draw these forces together that will really work. Now the question is, of course, what will the state do when that happens? This began to emerge briefly in Zimbabwe to the north of South Africa. When the MDC first emerged, it looked like this was a popular movement that could bring about change against Mugabe and his ZANU government. Well, in fact, they won the first two or three elections they were allowed to compete in, but they weren't allowed to win, even though they did. And one fears that what's going to happen in South Africa is that as the populace turns left and progressive and wants to have their own voices heard, the government will return even more to the right. And Marikana is a sign of that in a number of different ways, obviously. But it's a very ominous future for South Africa that it foretells, but it's also a very promising one. And I think that those of us who are involved in the anti-apartheid struggle have to be ready to re-enlist as supporters of a struggle for genuine liberation this time, not the kind of liberation that we've seen.
I know you've been working with people in South Africa. There's a vast discussion going on in South Africa amongst people there and amongst the expatriate population who's worked in South Africa, discussing how one would create that kind of bloc. There's all of the elements, an enormous discontent, a tremendous inequality, a recognition of the failure of liberation movement to actually reconstruct the economy in favor of the majority, a sense of the corruption that's occurred, a sense of the devastation of the environment in South Africa, which is quite extreme, actually, in many ways, especially in a country with insufficient water. All of those issues are now coming to a boil. But what are the sort of the avenues for this sort of counter-hegemonic bloc that would, unlike Zimbabwe, be impossible, be very, very difficult to suppress just by the force of arms?
Well, I think there are two sides to this. One is the side of the ANC itself. And I think, although it's difficult to say this now within two or three days of Mandela's death, I think in some ways the death itself, his death itself, may be a beginning of an opening. Because to some degree the ANC continues to be hegemonic insofar as it is still today, in part because of the mythology that accrues around the almost sainted figure of Mandela. The mythology is partly true. There's no question. He's a very important and able and courageous person. But I think with him gone, it may be harder to sell the ANC as the old ANC of Mandela. It will have to stand even more nakedly on its own terms. And I think that's not going to be a winning strategy. So then the question comes, what do people do if who want to bring about change? Well, there are those in the ANC who think that with the SACP, etc., the South African Communist Party, etc., there's a left in the ANC that could begin to revive some of its faded promise. Well, I'm not convinced of that. I don't think that's true. But finding an alternative that ties together all the kinds of resistances that are occurring around the country, that preempts the dangers of other things like xenophobia and this, that, and corruption and crime taking over in that society, that's going to be a hard thing to do. People are doing it. I'm in contact with one group, the Democratic Left Front, that is trying to, by all sorts of means, meetings and publications and linkages to various groups in different areas, begin to talk about what a new national politics might look like. Vavi, the current head of CASATU, is a bit under fire, particularly from the right, but also because he's done some rather foolish things in the gender area in terms of his own sexual practices. He's disqualified himself in a certain way to be believable. But on the other hand, he has taken the position and did exemplify it against the will of the ANC that the trade union movement, CASATU, has to reach out to these community organizations. There has to be more of an alliance of the forces for possible change in South Africa, to some degree against the established ANC-SACP government. So I think these kinds of things are straws in the wind of new kinds of organizations. It's much too early to say that any of them are the way forward or any of them are going to be terribly successful in the short run. But the long run is on their side if, in fact, the ANC doesn't become as oppressive as ZANU became under Mugabe. And that remains to be seen.
Everybody is facing that problem around the world, that the repressive forces could, in fact, really revert to unmistakable fascist methods. How are people thinking about how to counter that?
The one point of reference that you have to take is that when you and I began in anti-apartheid work and were involved in certain things that were happening in South Africa, say in 1960, it looked like an impossible situation. This is a regime, the white regime, that is prepared to use almost any method to suppress resistance. So I think that people take some promise from the fact that they've done it once. They stood up to white oppression and transformed capitalism, albeit not got rid of it, but at least made it more reform-minded than it ever was likely to have been otherwise, by popular resistance of a very widespread kind. Now, the thing is that it began to take form around things like CASATU and around things like the UDF that were organized. There was also an ANC in exile that was prepared to come back and, unfortunately in some ways, become the leader of these forces. But I think the same logic applies now. There is a beginning of a resistance. There's no doubt about that. There are trade union movements that are counter to the more conservative line that many CASATU unions are taking. There are organizations at the grassroots level that could begin to form a national movement. So I think it's just a question of very hard work to bring together these various diverse voices into a more coherent union. Now, that's not going to happen easily. And I wouldn't want to predict how many years it will take to build a movement. But I think that's the same logic that people in the 1960s faced. Biko, when he was writing in the early days, and so on. How do we build a movement that could even credibly confront this monster of the apartheid state? Well, no, not easy. But it was done up to a point. and it can be done again.
John Saul, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Normally feel like I don't wanna know her, but I've been feeling the change. Get out my way, man, I just wanna grow her. Oh, trying to fix by a place I once saw in a dream. Poker art sun, bloody left my sun cream. Poking out my liver while I shiver all day. And drums keep playing, rabble won't stay. Drunk the local wares until I felt a bit giddy. Acting all silly, Marley's all on the telly. Life change cunning, but these west legs running. Cool the sack, intimate, I ain't that relevant. Heavens above, man, I've been waiting a while. Why won't the season change? Lights ain't on, I can't be cracking a smile. Why won't the season change? Ooh, cried out, but still I'm shedding a tear.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning, and that track was from a newly released album by Africa Express called Maison de Juna. That's Ghost Poet, Season Change. It's an amazing album. I'll say a little bit more about that at the end of the show. Later in our program, we'll have Bill Resnick interviewing American historian and writer Paul Buell. They'll discuss his latest graphic book project, Radical Jesus. And Tom Becker will read from John Bellamy Foster's latest article, The Epochal Crisis, where he argues that capitalism has entered an epochal crisis that is unsustainable and with consequences as yet unknown. Well, Stephen Bantu Biko would have celebrated his 67th birthday last week. Biko, who was assassinated in September 1977, was a founder of the Black Consciousness Movement in South Africa and credited with empowering and mobilizing the urban black population. We'll hear more about Biko, Steve Biko, in our next segment with Jan Hocken as she interviews South African psychologist Derek Hook about his new book, Post-Apartheid Conditions, Psychoanalysis, and Social Formations.
Good morning, Derek Hook.
Hello, Jan. How are you?
Good. Good to have you on the show. You've written quite a bit on South Africa as a South African psychologist, psychoanalyst. In your recent book, Post-Apartheid Conditions, Psychoanalysis, and Social Formations, you focus quite a bit on what you call temporality as a way of thinking about everyday consciousness in South Africa. Can you explain that concept and what you think is important about it, specifically to the South African experience of everyday social psychology?
Yes, one of the reasons that I was inspired by the idea of time or temporality or experiences of time was that often, historically, political critiques and analyses of the South African situation and the asymmetry of social power, divided structure of the country, has focused on space, on divisions of territory, of divisions of land, and have thought the spatiality of power. And I suppose what I wanted to do is also think a little bit about how experiences of time, and particularly experiences of transformation, are also a crucial dimension and a crucial way of approaching what's happening in the post-apartheid period. So time seems to me, and the experience of time seems to me, an important way to think about the existing structures of power in South Africa, and also, of course, as a way of trying to understand how further change may happen.
Now, you take this idea of time and awareness of the historical situation into your focus on the work of Steve Biko and the Black Consciousness Movement. Can you, first of all, explain a bit who Steve Biko was and his place in the Black Consciousness Movement in South Africa, and also how he was both a man of his time and continues to be a man of the moment in South Africa?
Yes, Steve Biko became an important focus for the book because he seems to be one of the cases in point of historical persona, a man of his time, who somehow, since his death in 1977, has become even more relevant to South Africa, you could argue, than when he was alive. So just a little bit of context, Steve Biko was a leader of black consciousness, the black consciousness movement in South Africa. He was killed in September 1977 by the security police in South Africa, who were aware of his activism and his politics. He died when he was very young. He was in his early 30s. I think he was 31. And he was really an inspirational figure for many people, because one of the key moves he made, and of course why he's also of interest to me, not just politically, but as a person who's interested in psychology, is that his key political aim was to be able to increase a sense of agency, of pride, and indeed of some kind of power within the oppressed black community of, or black communities of South Africa in the heights of apartheid, in the middle of the 1970s when apartheid was, as you could argue, perhaps at its most brutal.
Well, hasn't that always been a part of movements of resistance, that there is a part of any transformative project that the oppressed have to kind of project the bad back onto the oppressor and restore a sense of their own kind of collective value, one might say a kind of healthy narcissism or a sense of capacity or worth or value by putting the bad back onto the oppressor? Are you saying that this was explicit in the thinking of the Black Consciousness Movement in a different way? You know, there's always, you know, sisterhood is powerful, black is beautiful, that all movements have to kind of reclaim their value out from under a kind of degraded representation of themselves in the eyes of the, their masters.
Yes. I mean, I think that point is worth stressing. It was very much a part of black consciousness, as it was articulated by Biko and colleagues, to say that unless you deal with the psychological dimension of oppression, unless you deal with the factor of crushed cultural heritage, marginalized senses of self-identity, marginalized senses of agency, you're not really going to be able to enable structural political change. Or put differently, even if there was structural political change, if the previously oppressed group doesn't have a sense of confidence, competence, ability to move beyond and transform what the future may be, then political transformation will not ultimately succeed. So that, I suppose, is the first point. Then the second point is, you were suggesting, was it necessary to have a negative image of the oppressor? I think black consciousness tried to not focus too much on building up the image of the white oppressor, even by virtue of demonizing it. Again and again, you have this refrain in Biko where he's saying, don't think about the whites the whole time. Let's, for a moment, let's think about what blacks can do. And this is really crucial to black consciousness. And one of the reasons is still interesting, at least the South African version of black consciousness today, is that it was pretty radical for its time, because lots of liberal white colleagues were saying, we want to work with you. We want to be white and black brothers and sisters against oppression. And Biko made a principled decision to say, we can't yet do that. If we try to have these so-called partnerships, inevitably, they will be run by whites. And we have this kind of custodianship, this paternalistic relationship of whites then prescribing what is the best way for blacks to resist apartheid. And he wanted to reject that. And so what's radical about that is something I think that's still worth thinking about today. And it's also one of the reasons that Biko becomes such a potent signifier, such a potent icon in contemporary post-apartheid South Africa.
This process of restoring a sense of capacity or value as a group project rather than primarily an individual project, which perhaps is what makes it political.
Yes, and of course then the great irony is that in some respects to elevate Biko above all other colleagues and to make him the kind of poster boy of black consciousness is also something that Biko is kind of critical of himself, because otherwise what you all too often happen is a kind of a discourse of exceptionalism. In other words, Biko himself is exceptional. But what he wanted to do and what was apparent in black consciousness politics was an ongoing changing of leaders or an attempt to nurture and develop leaders across communities so that the people have a sense of agency and that not that the people become fixated on the image of the single leader, the single leadership figure.
Has there also been a discussion in the revival of the Black Consciousness Movement of the problem of sexism and gender? There have been many black feminists in the U.S. that have criticized the Black Power Movement and the Black Panthers for retrieving that sense of healthy narcissism, but on the backs of women. And there's perhaps also an important step in not denying the importance of what are often assigned to men in terms of the capacity to be a fighter and feeling powerful, but also including women in those same roles, and also redistributing among across the gender divide traits such as nurture and care that are assigned to women. Is there a similar or anything along those same lines of a discussion in the current revival of Steve Biko's legacy?
Yes, very much so. I've been immersing myself in much of the literature, particularly on that historical period of the mid-70s, and you will find that there's a great deal of critical reflection on how black consciousness at times seemed to be articulated very much as the struggle of the black man. Now, of course, at the time, it involved a great number of different people, men and women, often working together, but nonetheless, those patriarchal gender dynamics often did come through, and there are many complaints and criticisms of that kind of politics. I mean, that's important to be upfront about. And I think many people today who would align themselves to black consciousness would like to move beyond that and view a different form of black consciousness. But I suppose one contextualizing point, which is worth considering, even if only briefly, is for me, there was something very innovative about thinking black consciousness politics. And what that meant was that a group of oppressed people who often didn't have much access to libraries, to books, to literature, to education indeed, had to try and formulate a kind of discourse, a series of almost militant but assertive and proud identities. They needed to do this, and they needed to find different kinds of a language with which to do it. So sometimes you find in black consciousness thought moments of black theology turned to religion. Sometimes you find a turns to what would obviously be called, I suppose, masculinist discourse. Again, the reference to black man and bravery and courage, what you might consider stereotypically male or masculine virtues, if you're thinking, you know, in patriarchal terms. I just want to add that is that all of these ideas, and of course also the turn to a psychological language, I don't think these are absolute, but it's an attempt to make do with what one can find. And of course the irony of the situation then is one is reformulating a political language with psychological concepts, sometimes religious and Christian concepts, and sometimes with some concepts which come to the forefront in patriarchy. So the irony of the situation is one needs to use what one can to try and establish and put forward a more assertive identity. Unfortunately, that does sometimes mean, I suppose, that one can fall prey to taking psychological terminology or even, you know, masculinist terms, which may not ultimately best serve one in the long run.
Historians of struggle music have often described a shift in tone as the movement went into a period of armed struggle from a more languid, soulful lamentation to a more of an insistent and urgent tone. Do you see echoes of the same shift in the psychology of the period and this idea of temporality of the psychology of everyday life?
One reflection on that, which also links back to your previous question, is to say that I think in the multiple different ways that people are thinking about black consciousness today, one has the feeling, yes, maybe it went through its kind of assertive, seemingly stereotypically masculine side, you know, even kind of aggressive, and you still see intellectuals of that sort operating in South Africa today. But I think it's also a sense that ultimately something like black consciousness isn't going to work if men can't also embrace stereotypically feminine virtues. In other words, it's not just the case that you would need women to be brave and courageous, whatever that, you know, stereotypically masculine qualities, but also that men would need to be loving and have a fidelity and a deep sense of feeling for the community as such. I just wanted to make that point that in the course of how black consciousness develops, one needs to think about all of those as political virtues and try to surpass the sense of how some may be thought of stereotypically masculine or feminine. But just also the other thing to mention is in terms of the male-female thing, one could argue that today in South Africa, the most vocal and the most visible proponent of black consciousness politics is a woman called Mamphele Ramphele, who had been associated with Steve Biko and, of course, now has her own political party and is becoming a very public persona and very much a part of what is happening in terms of the critique of today's ANC-led government and a voice for further change in South Africa.
Certainly in the aftermath of Mandela's death and the work that has been produced on the South African situation by the liberal all the way through to the left press in the U.S., it's quite a depressive outlook. And one might wonder how Steve Biko would look at the picture today. And in your own work, you try to balance the depressive position with the hopeful one for forms of reparation over time that are a process of people healing themselves in the world, that notion of tikkun. There's a way in which the pessimism and the deep disappointment in the South Africa that survived the collapse of apartheid or the partial collapse of apartheid can itself be a distancing from what has been accomplished. In closing, could you say a bit about how you try to balance the depressive and the hopeful side of the picture and perhaps what is going on in South Africa today that might give basis for hope and for supporting comrades and allies there?
Yeah, Jen, I think it's very important to bring that up because on the one hand, in discussing temporality, I've been aware of how one can refer to the post-apartheid era with brackets around the post. In other words, sometimes you get people who would argue that it's not really post, it's still a kind of continuation of apartheid in another form. But it's useful highlighting the ambiguity of that post because in some instances it really is post, that you do see different social forms, different cultural forms that weren't there before. So I want to keep that ambiguity in mind, but also just to agree with you, I think you need forms of progressive critique where you can say things about the temporality of South Africa, like things aren't changing in certain facets of society. Maybe there's even some backsliding. Maybe there's a repetition. Maybe there's some kind of historical stasis or suspension where there isn't change happening. But of course, in other facets of life, there is. And sometimes maybe they're the smallest, but sometimes we don't just have a frozen history or a repeated history or a returning history, but an acceleration of historical temporality, historical tempo. One experience that really brought that home to me was doing some research work for the book at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. This is an institution which had for a long time been, you know, a hotbed of apartheid ideologues, a kind of white and Afrikaans institution that even as an English-speaking South African, I found very intimidating and you know, really wanted to go that close to. And I'd read comments of politicized black colleagues saying, don't ever go there. This was in the time of apartheid because you will inevitably get beaten up if you walk onto this campus. And of course, what I've discovered since visiting the campus more recently is that I think some of the most strenuous forms of critique and social engagement and young black intellectuals working within some parts of South Africa are precisely there. So I think some of those things would have been completely unforeseeable in earlier history of South Africa. And it's really, really important to keep those moments of life, of new and critical innovation, foremost in mind, because otherwise one makes this error of saying, well, there's things that are bad about South Africa. There's things that are bad about the government. It's going to be another failed African state. And that kind of pessimism, even when it seems to dress itself up in a progressive, critical voice, isn't helping.
And some of those projects are carried on through the Steve Biko Foundation. I just, in closing, wanted to direct our listeners to the Steve Biko Foundation that has many interesting projects, including an ongoing radio station on new critical dialogues, and also to encourage our listeners to get your book. It's a fabulous book, a very, I think, interesting look at psychology in South Africa, and specifically the contribution of Steve Biko on the Black Consciousness Movement, not only to a psychology of South Africa, but a general psychology. That's Post-Apartheid Conditions, Psychoanalysis and Social Formation by Derek Hook. Thanks so much for being with us on the show this morning, Derek.
Oh, it was wonderful. Thank you too, Jen.
If you miss it, you'll be sorry. I gotta tell a little tale about a life.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. You just heard City Says La by Gang of Instrumentals. They're a South African urban pop group and they're based in Johannesburg. They're known for their fusion of musical styles. We'll hear more from them. Those styles include hip-hop, street rap, pop, soul, reggae, R&B. They don't miss a beat. And again, we'll play a little bit more from those folks at the end of the program. Coming up on KBOO this morning at 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia is off. We'll hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein, who discusses two proposed pipeline projects, which would carry tar sands-derived heavy crude oil to the Pacific coast. Her guest is Matt Grugg, tar sands SOS campaign director for Forest Ethics. At 11 on Disability Awareness, host Grace Reed interviews Laura Sandow, a veteran with a disability, about hidden disabilities. Following Disability Awareness, we'll hear Health and Healthcare Forum host Roberta Hall speak with Lillian Shirley, the director of the Public Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority, and Brian Johnson, the new president of the Oregon Public Health Association. They'll talk about health transformation and ways to better integrate personal medical care with public health. We want to thank our KBOO members for your generous support for community radio. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Well, next up on The Old Mole, we will hear again from Bill Resnick, who interviews American historian Paul Buell. They discuss his graphic book project, Radical Jesus.
Hi, Paul Buell. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much, Bill. I'm happy to be there.
Paul Buell is the editor, a producer of the book Radical Jesus, a graphic history. Paul's a historian, written a lot on the left in Hollywood, done a great deal of other work too, including oral histories of old lefties and studies of American radicalism. Paul, it's December 23rd. The Christian world, Christian countries, they're celebrating the life and death of and continuing significance of a Jewish Palestinian who was crucified for trying to build a movement against the money changers, against the high priest, and for achieving grace in the kingdom of heaven by working for peace and justice, helping the poor, the sick, the imprisoned. Of course, the Romans and their collaborators, with their magnificent palaces and wealth, found this carpenter's son to be quite a thorn in their side, and they did a public and gory execution, that to silence him and to frighten his followers. That effort to stifle the movement was one of the great historical failures, I guess. Paul, tell us about the Radical Jesus, the book, and the various chapters and its themes.
I would say that the revolt against empire is the central theme. Everything else flows from that. And the revolt against empire is the theme that's most important today in the world. The empires are in control. The masses of great masses of ordinary people face declining standards of living, ecological catastrophe, and all those things. And only a person far more narrow than myself would declare that Jesus is the answer to all these problems. But on the other hand, the history of revolt against authority in the name of Christianity is quite an impressive history, and it has a large future as well as a past. So this book consists of three parts drawn as comic stories. The first part is by Sabrina Jones, a Quaker activist, and it's really about things in the lifetime of Christ. But within the text is posed the struggles of Occupy and other things of the present day, so we can tell which side Jesus is on during these struggles. The second part, beautifully drawn by Gary Dum, is about the Radical Reformation. That is from the 14th century revolt of Wat Tyler in England and the translation of the Bible by John Wycliffe through the Central European struggles that Engels wrote about so wonderfully in his History of Peasant Rebellions and their partial victories over the power and kingdom of the church linked with authority and also their martyrdom. And the third part really is mostly about the U.S. and about solidarity movements from the days of abolitionism through the struggles in support of revolutions in Vietnam and Latin America, among other places. And that third section is drawn by Nick Torkelson. And it's a dialogue reimagined of himself in the solidarity movements that he was very much a part of in blue-collar Somerville, Massachusetts, from the 1970s to 1990s. So it looks out to these people, or perfectly ordinary, mostly Catholic people he was working with, and what they believed and how they put themselves to the test in various ways in solidarity. Now, I have to break in and say, I'm surrounded by avians, or as I like to call them, avian Americans, cockatiel, ringneck parrot, parakeet, and canary. And if you hear someone chiming in, it's because they're ready to come out of the cage for the rest of the day, and they're still enclosed. They add to the interest of the interview, I hope.
I thought you were on Maui or some tropical paradise. This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Paul Buell about the book that he edited, wrote some for, produced, that is, got published, now trying to promote, called Radical Jesus. It's a wonderful work, especially for teenagers and younger kids, to talk about with their parents about, in fact, the real historical Jesus, who was quite a, what should we say, an agitator, leader, but also a democratic leader. Tell us some, let's talk about some of the themes, and particularly how Jesus has been used over the years by Christian movements that have challenged various kinds of authority. In particular, Jesus was anathema to the Romans because he challenged top-down rule by wealthy people and the magnificent palaces also of course, the high church. He's a tremendous challenger to the high church. The Jewish priesthood really didn't like him. And that's, of course, part of the book.
Very important part of the book, because in Sabrina Jones's rendition, the rich man comes to Jesus and says, "Here I've been following all of the practices of religion all my life, and I've got all this money, I'm rich, everything is good for me." And Jesus says to him, "Don't store up your treasures on earth where moth and rust devour and thieves break in. Save up your treasure in heaven for where your treasure is." That not meaning everything is afterlife, but meaning give up your wealth.
Or share your wealth, sort of.
Your wealth is pulling you down. Look to those who are suffering, or the standard story, which I heard in childhood, was turning to the beggar and then to the crowd of religious people and saying, "If you didn't help this person, then you aren't serious about your religion."
Yeah.
If you don't see the homeless as central to your understanding of society, then you're entirely mistaken.
Yeah.
And that's a good lesson.
Right. Well, and the accumulation of wealth is the road to hell, which is, of course, a living hell, is what, in fact, so many of the characters we celebrate is what they live, actually. The road to wealth, the need to protect it, the fear of the underlings, the lack of solidarity, the way they fool themselves, the way they have to protect. I mean, the life of the rich is really quite absurd. I mean, Jesus sort of understood that the life of worshiping possessions is a living death.
Not only that, but also of the religious leaders who supported wealth. Sabrina has a nice page of Jesus saying, "Beware of religious leaders. They preach, but they don't practice. They like to go around in long robes and be saluted in the marketplace and have places of honor at banquets." And then in large letters, "Woe to you, you hypocrites!" Exclamation mark.
Paul, talk about liberation theology and the way Jesus was used in liberation theology as a democratic community, not a top-down community.
That's very important. I was only a popularist writing about liberation theology in places like The Nation magazine, The Village Voice, and so forth. But what I learned in the early 1980s was that the struggles in Latin America, various parts of Latin America and the Caribbean, to answer the crushing of left-wing movements by military governments supported by the U.S., to answer those things with a new gospel, so to speak, the gospel of the poor, the necessity for everyone to share what possessions there are and defend the ecosphere of the jungles and the inhabitants of all kinds within those spaces, and of course the surviving indigenous tribes. And that liberation theology was viewed as extremely dangerous by the U.S., by the rulers of those countries, by the church leaders, most of the church leaders in those countries, and above all by the Vatican. So those movements were drowned in blood and crushed from within, but never entirely destroyed. And now under Pope Francis, one assumes they are going to undergo a great return. And that return must be against the ridiculous degrees of wealth, against the destructions of what remains of the rainforests, and all those other things that liberation theology was able to raise that the secular left focused on the specific view of Marxism, focused on industrial workers, was not able to articulate or, so to speak, evangelized to the widest population. It remained to liberation theology to do that. So it's a crucial thing, and we're going to see more and more of it in the world today and tomorrow.
Yeah, I think we'll have to have another interview, Paul, about Francis. I hope you're watching him, actually, as the new pope. I think that's the crucial question. Will he, in fact, support liberation theology, or will he remain sort of the great father and the patriarch? Yeah. And in some ways, he signals the former, but it's not at all clear that the people at the top of the church are going to listen to that in any way.
Indeed, but we'll keep our eye on him and also on the nuns on the bus.
Yes, oh, exactly. But also all those parishioners who are told to actually take power in the church and indeed have services of their own and have participatory services where everybody is asked to both read and comment and tell their stories. In some ways, some of those churches are probably the best of Alcoholics Anonymous, where everybody participates, tell their stories, and it is really participatory. And the priesthood is not at all interested in that, actually. So it seems to me there's a really huge contradiction. We'll see how that works out. Paul Buell, thanks so much for talking to us, and buy the book, actually. You want me to say that? You want to say that? You should buy the book for teenage people and talk to them about it.
It was created so that it could be read by 12-year-olds in Sunday school, but it's equally readable by old-timers such as ourselves.
Yes, and nice picture. I mean, it's very, very interesting. There's a lot in all of those pictures.
It's an art comic.
Yeah.
Beautifully drawn color art comic.
Yes. Paul Buell, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill.
Right, so long.
That is more from Gang of Instrumentals, Shake It. I thought a nice follow-up to our discussion about Jesus, Radical Jesus, who might have shaken it at some point. Let's hope. To close out today's show, we have Tom Becker talking about Shake It. We're going to talk about capitalism and epochal crisis. Tom?
Good morning. There's a growing consensus among serious-minded people that the global capitalist system could implode under the weight of its own contradictions and inadequacies within a very foreseeable future. Whether such a collapse will initiate an unmitigated disaster for our species and the entire planet, or inaugurate the dawning of a more just and equitable world, hangs in the balance. Today I'm going to share excerpts from an article entitled The Epochal Crisis by John Bellamy Foster, dealing with this very question. As an indication, Foster begins, of the sheer enormity of the historical challenge confronting humanity in our time, that the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, sometimes now called the Second Great Depression, is overshadowed by the larger threat of planetary catastrophe, raising the question of the long-term survival of innumerable species, including our own. An urgent necessity for the world today is therefore to develop an understanding of the interconnections between the deepening impasse of the capitalist economy and the rapidly accelerating ecological threat, itself a byproduct of capitalist development. I should use the term epical crisis here to refer to the convergence of economic and ecological contradictions in such a way that the material conditions of society as a whole are undermined, posing the question of an historical transition to a new mode of production. This can be distinguished from the ordinary developmental crises that punctuate the history of capitalism. Such an epical crisis, as Jason Moore has argued, characterized the transition from feudalism to capitalism from the late medieval period to the 17th century. A crisis of an entire historical epoch that was equally ecological, economic, and social in its manifestations, stretching from the current famine, the Black Death, and soil exhaustion to peasant revolts and the escalation of warfare. An even more momentous epochal crisis than the one that produced the transition from feudalism to capitalism, I will argue, is occurring today, arising from the unlimited expansion of a capitalist system geared to the process of abstract wealth creation. The economic dimensions of the epochal crisis are and can be described in terms of three mutually reinforcing trends: monopolization, stagnation, and financialization, combined at the world level with the global labor arbitrage. The late 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century saw the emergence of the monopoly stage of capitalism, arising out of the concentration and centralization of capital. The typical firm is now a quasi-monopoly with considerable monopoly power with respect to price, output, and investment. From a global perspective, it is important to recognize that the periphery of the world capitalist system is subject to most, if not all, of the economic and ecological contradictions of monopoly capitalism, while also being subject to those specific inequities imposed by imperialism. The pillage of the global South has never depended simply on unequal economic exchange, but also has relied throughout on unequal ecological exchange. Free trade is an ideal based on the assumption of equitable exchange, but free trade may develop countries rich with high standards of living, leaving less developed countries devastated. In the foregoing analysis, I have argued that the epical crisis of our time emanates from a dangerous and disruptive intersection of economic and ecological contradictions, traceable to the growing distortion, displacement, and degradation of natural material use values. This is tied not only to the accumulation process directly, but also to the acceleration of environmental throughput that it entails and the accompanying rift in the biogeochemical processes of the planet. In Marx's hopeful vision, mankind inevitably sets itself only such tasks as it is able to solve, since closer examination will always show that the problem itself arises only when the material conditions for its solution are already present, or at least in the course of formation, end quote. Today, the material potential exists, both economically and ecologically, to overcome the epochal crisis of our times. This potential is manifested in the exploitation, waste, idle capacity, displacement of use values, and rapacious destruction of real wealth that characterizes the present system. The gigantic misuse of human and natural resources that constitutes the modern capitalist economy means that we already have the potential many times over to redirect production and consumption to meet human needs and to practice conservation on a global level, creating a society of ecological sustainability and substantive equality. Accomplishing this, though, means breaking with capitalism's expansionist drive, which is now destroying the Earth as a safe operating space for humanity through the crossing of critical planetary boundaries. This is manifested in such planetary rifts as climate change, ocean acidification, destruction of the ozone layer, species extinction, the disruption of the nitrogen and phosphorus cycles, loss of fresh water, loss of land cover, and chemical pollution. For capitalism, time is money, and the future of humanity and the Earth is therefore systematically discounted within the cash nexus. Monopoly capital alters the use value structure of the economy itself, generating specifically capitalist use values that are frequently negative in character in order to accelerate commodity circulation, the level of environmental throughput, and overall production, with the sole object of generating more wealth for the wealthy in the present. After me, the deluge, is thus the spirit of capitalism, particularly in its present phase of monopoly finance capital. It follows that the current epical crisis requires a no less epical transition from one mode of production to another, reminiscent of the transition from feudalism to capitalism, but on a far bigger scale. Indeed, what is needed is the kind of global epical structural change advocated by Marx. How will the necessary revolutionary transition come about? I am convinced that objective forces today are progressively erasing previous distinctions between workplace exploitation and environmental degradation, as capitalism universally undermines all real material conditions of production. All of this depends, of course, on the rise to prominence of an environmental working class, an ecological peasantry, capable of initiating a broad counter-hegemonic struggle for the fulfillment of human needs in line with the fundamental biogeochemical processes of the planet, a world of substantive equality and ecological sustainability. There is no doubt that this is an objective necessity and that it will increasingly become a subjective one as well. Yet there is no certainty as to the future of humanity. The very continuation of the human species, along with most of the other higher forms of life, is now in doubt. The future, and even survival of humanity, thus rests as never before on the revolutionary struggle of humanity itself. That was an excerpt from an article entitled The Epical Crisis by John Bellamy Foster. The entire article can be found on this month's Monthly Review website. John Bellamy Foster is the editor of the Monthly Review and professor of sociology at the University of Oregon.
That is Chanson Denko Tapestry by Yakuba Sissoko. That is also on the recently released album Maison de Juna by Africa Express. Maison de Juna is translated as Youth Club. The album was recorded in Mali at this club. It's a collaboration between African musicians and Western musicians, and the Africa Express has been around for a while. The album just came out this year, actually in September, and it's mostly been with the intention of appreciating African music and culture, and to demonstrate the kind of ways that Western and African music has fused and certainly made some very interesting stuff to listen to. So I encourage folks to go online and look at Africa Express. We also listen to some music by a Gang of Instrumentals. They're also a very widely renowned band in South Africa and do some very interesting and fun music. Yes, so it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're closing down the show for this morning. It is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning. I want to thank our Old Moles, Bill Resnick, Jan Hawken, and Tom Becker. Also today's guests, we had John Saul talking about South Africa, Derek Hook, a South African psychologist, talking with Jan Hawken about his new book, and Paul Buell, who was talking about his book project, Radical Jesus. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. Joe Clement has been our engineer, and we will be back again next Monday.
And good morning. It's 10 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland. Coming up this morning, Eric Cascadia is off, and on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein discusses two proposed pipeline projects which would carry tar sands-derived heavy crude oil to the Pacific coast. She'll be talking with Matt Krogh, Tar Sands SOS Campaign Director for Forest Ethics. And at 11, on Disability Awareness, host Grace Greed interviews Laura Sandow, a veteran with a disability, about hidden disabilities. And at 11:30 on Health and Healthcare Forum, host Roberta Hall speaks with Lillian Shirley, the director of the Public Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority, and Brian Johnson, the new president of the Oregon Public Health Association, about health transformation and ways to better integrate personal medical care with public health. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Fire! KBOO is proud to co-sponsor a New Year's Eve Afrobeat and Salsa dance party with live performances from Palante and Jujuba in a benefit for Mercy Corps at the Red Rose Ballroom on Northeast Alberta and 19th on New Year's Eve, Tuesday, December 31st, from 9 p.m. till 1 a.m., and a salsa lesson at 8:30. Musical worlds converge when Nigerian Afrobeat band Jujuba and Afro-Cuban salsa and Latin band Palante bring the community out for this high-energy dance party to support the international relief work of Mercy Corps. The New Year's Eve celebration is at the Red Rose Ballroom on Northeast Alberta and 19th. For details, please go to kboo.fm and click on the New Year's Eve dance party link on the lower right side of the page.
Tune in at 6 p.m. Wednesday, December 25th, Christmas Day, for The Underground. Hosted by the KBOO Youth Collective, the show this month will feature stories and other works on the theme of magic. Learn about magician secrets, witches, Harry Potter, and more. That's Wednesday the 25th at 6 p.m. Christmas Day here on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses...